stories. If you miss a show, you can always check out our archives at PRN.FM. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Hi, this is Professor T. Love of A Bowl of Soul, a mixed stew of soul music. Come get your history lesson in soul music on Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. Tune in as I play soul music from 1949 to the present. Also, listen to A Bowl of Soul in the archives. If you like A Bowl of Soul, rate us in iTunes. Come and catch a groove on A Bowl of Soul. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
This is the Progressive Radio Network, information for the independent mind.
Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Hello and good morning to you all, everybody. This is Richard Martin of the Wake Up Call, coming to you as always from the sultry climes of Singapore. And this is the 27th of April 2012. And we are going to have an hour of goodly chat and discussion. And hopefully we'll get some calls today. But one way or another, let's start out with the Frontline program, which I watched. That's the long program, actually, on the economy that came out this week. I'd mentioned it to you, if you remember, on Monday's show. It's actually an excellent statement of the events and the timeline that took place over the last 6 or 7 years, and it's really quite accurate. But I was really disappointed that it is just in fact a puff piece, implicitly supporting every step the government took over the 2008 crisis. In fact, the only criticism that I could identify was of poor old John McCain, who had nothing whatever to do with the crisis, and he was lambasted for not taking what they called a leadership role in the meeting, the famous meeting that took place in October just before the election, when, if you remember, he had ostentatiously suspended his campaign to help out the experts, of which he is manifestly not one. I somewhat doubt that if McCain had become president, Frontline would have included even that criticism of him. Any opinions? Oh, well. In a recent interview on King World News, Richard Yamarone has this to say, and I quote, "I'm fortunate enough to travel and speak to chambers of commerce with 300 to 500 people in the audience. They all tell me, hey, listen, I'm letting go of workers. I'm hiring them back at a fraction of what I used to pay them. You hear from the other side, hey, I finally got a job after 2 years of being unemployed. I used to make $100,000 each year. Now I'm making $45,000, or now I'm working part-time. Or, you hear, I used to make $500,000 and now I'm making $200,000, or making $125,000. End of quote. So you are actually seeing this collapse, contracting on a real basis of real disposable personal incomes. If you don't have the money, you can't facilitate expenditures. So you see, that's the core of the problem. That's what's really going on in the U.S. economy. You don't listen to what all these bigger numbers coming across the screen tell you. You talk to the people who are running the country. 99.7% of all employer firms in the United States are small businesses. So when they speak, you have to listen. You have to listen to what the small businesses are telling you. And right now, they're telling you, hey, I'm the head of a third or fourth generation, 75 or 100-year-old business, and I've got to shut the doors, or I've got to let people go. And if I'm hiring anybody back, it's only on a temporary basis. Sometimes they do this through a hiring firm so that they can sidestep paying unemployment benefit insurance. So you see, ladies and gentlemen, that's what's really going on at the grassroots level of the economy. Very, very grossly different from what you're seeing in some of these numbers coming out in earnings releases. Monetary policy is very different from the days when the U.S. was an industrial behemoth. If you look at the first eight recessions after World War II, when the country was a big manufacturer back then, if the Fed saw a problem, they cut rates, and boom, manufacturers sparked up their dead plants and factories. In fact, the first eight recessions after World War II, it took on average 20 months for the country to respond and get all of the jobs back that it lost during the recession. So in a little less than 2 years, the Fed response would get all of the jobs back. But now you see, if you look at the last two recessions, in 1991 and in 2001, they were jobless recoveries. The U.S. didn't respond to monetary policy the same way, because it's no longer that manufacturing behemoth. So the Fed cuts rates at the first sign of trouble, and it takes, during those recessions, 40 months for the country to get back all of the job it lost. In this current recession, the country isn't even close to getting the jobs back. And that's 50 months and counting. They kept talking about a package to rescue the American financial system. There isn't a system. There is no machine with a master on-off switch, nor a head with a massive headache or tumor to be treated. The concept known as Wall Street is a far-flung constellation of competing firms. Some are banks, some are investment houses, brokers, mutual funds, funds of funds, insurance companies, etc. Half of Wall Street isn't even in New York. A big chunk's in Europe. The entire world has a stake, one way or another, in U.S. tradable paper, issued by hundreds of firms whose star of fortune might rise or fall from day to day. No system, no single cure to fix a single problem. And you see, that's why Paulson was obviously lying. He intended to rescue some players, not others, and certainly not everyone. Apparently, Frontline was unable or unwilling to see all of this. Throwing money at the banks was an asinine idea. Recapitalizing the banks without any strings is like giving a gambling addict money to stop his legs from getting broken. Instead of paying off the debt, the money enabled them to place even larger, riskier bets. Look, if I have a $10 million short position on a bank, I would be really, really happy to loan them $5 million and hope they went bankrupt. But I can't hedge. Going the opposite way on equity and debt used to be a popular hedge. But no short on equity, no long on debt. And we were shocked to see the credit markets freeze. Look, I believe in completely freed markets, but banks seemed to want to have it both ways. They didn't want to show the portfolios of securities. Some might be toxic waste, some good. They didn't want an exchange to trade the CDOs, MBSs, whatever, where there would be a bid and ask, margin requirements, and a market price. Oh, no, 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 no. They wanted to be able to claim they were worth whatever they decided and book them as profits when they were going up. But they would be the ones to control the valuation. There are actually parallels with the Japanese banks keeping dub loans on their books through the 1990s, or on America's S&Ls trading the dead horse for the dead cow until the music stopped. That was the core of the problem, you see. How can you recapitalize something whose books are completely opaque? Or even having a small opaque box which might have a financial neutron bomb like the off-balance sheet debt vehicles Enron used. Who are the counterparties? They aren't exchanges. The securities aren't traded. And some end up in court trying to determine the nuances of some legalese. Were J.P. Morgan, Bank of America, or Citigroup liquid and or insolvent? Who knows? And if you don't know and can't by law hedge, why loan to them? None of this apparently was obvious to the makers of the frontline program. The section on the government intervention in late 2008 had people like Paulson presented in sort of godlike black and white and waiting in deep contemplation. And Bernanke, likewise, in semi-meditation with that famous look that he has of his hands clasped as if in deep prayer. You know, the genius is at work. Come on, these were overgrown school kids stealing dad's car and careening around like hooligans. On September the 25th, 2008, progressives came together in 251 emergency rallies in 41 states saying no to the $700 billion Bush corporate bailout for Wall Street. Remember that? As a result, the tax giveaway, assumed to be a done deal only a few days earlier, was stalled and being reconsidered by lawmakers who were stunned by the speed and scale of America's reaction. Paulson, along with the bankers, Hedges and Bushes, had no argument for their corporate handout. That's why they'd made vague threats of doom unless their proposal and nothing else was passed. This is a cheap debating trick of posing your opponent a false dilemma of two choices. Anyone who thinks that their audience is stupid, anyone who falls for it is stupid. Instead, Congress turned to work on an economic recovery package for Main Street. Well, as you may remember, this was accepted and agreed upon by Paulson and was the very condition for Congress's final approval. Then he turned round 10 days later and gave the money to the banks anyway. Not a peep from anyone. Don't get me started on this, please. Paulson and his friends pitched this proposal as an accounting fix. But really, the right way to analyze it is in terms of game theory. You see, the man in the street intuitively understood this. The bankster's intentions were naked for all the world to see and for all those who cared to look. It wasn't pretty. Bankruptcy wasn't and isn't the problem. Bankruptcy is the solution. The FDIC's takeover of Washington Mutual showed us the correct way to deal with the banking crisis, so-called. If the FDIC had got busy and closed just a couple of dozen more banks with balance sheets that sank to high heaven, the entire crisis could have been over, just like that. There wouldn't have been any need for a bailout of any kind. The stockholders and bondholders of the weak and dying banks would have lost big bucks, but they are exactly the people who should have taken the hit on this. The rest of society would have got nothing but benefits. The bank's assets would have been transferred to a well-managed bank with a strong balance sheet, who would have begun to loan against them again. The economy would have got moving again. The U.S. taxpayer and Congress could have gone back to sleep. No $700 billion bailout, no increase in the federal debt, no social injustice. And best of all, it would have been a quick fix. You know, the FDIC is already in place, obviously capable of doing the job. All they would have needed was a little bit of encouragement from Bush to move things along and get things resolved. Ay, 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 ay. Talk about woulda, coulda, shoulda. But of course, nothing about this from Frontline. Nothing. Very disturbing to me. I always thought Frontline was a program that would put on really constructive and critical talk and approach to this sort of stuff. Nothing. What a shame. What a missed opportunity. Well, you know, Iceland let the banks go bust and actually expanded its social safety net, where everyone else bailed out the bankers and made the public pay the price. And look how nicely Iceland is coming out of its crisis, where everyone else was fixated on trying to placate international investors. Iceland imposed temporary controls on the movement of capital to give itself room to maneuver. And they are, of course, now much, much better for it than the countries like the US and Ireland who did not. Iceland did the right thing by making sure its payment systems continued to function while creditors, not the taxpayers, shouldered the losses of banks. Ah, you know, America is supposed to be the great genius of business and finance, not little Iceland. The truth is that America is just an imposter, full of bluster and hype, but in the end, utterly unable to deliver. The scope and magnitude of the bank rescue packages also meant that significant risks had been transferred onto government balance sheets. This was particularly apparent in the market for CDSs, referencing the United States itself, either in large individual bank rescues or in broad-based support packages for the financial sector. CDSs were thinly traded before the announced rescue packages. Then spreads widened suddenly on increased demand for creditor protection, while corresponding financial sector spreads tightened. In other words, by assuming huge portions of the risk from banks trading in toxic derivatives, and by spending trillions that they didn't have, the country has now put itself at grave risk from default. Ladies and gentlemen, these derivatives are desperately dangerous. They will blow up, and they will consign the country to decades of economic oblivion. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it is going to happen. Okay, let me give you my info. Phone number, the toll-free number for you all to call in one after the other, giving your views, opinions, and getting together a nice little discussion together. Oh, well, it's 888-874-4888. Again, that's our toll-free number. There are several lines, so we can field you all. Just call in, and the number again is 888-874-4888. And the email address for you to write in your questions, if you would like to do it that way, is rm@gfawd.com. That's RM for Richard Martin. GFAWD is Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design .com. Once more, rm@gfawd.com. And my direct line, if you want to talk to me about your individual issues and conundra, you can call me on a number in Sarasota, Florida, area code 941-441-1682. Again, that's 941-441-1682. Well, we have now our next monthly meetup group meeting coming up on Sunday, and that meetup group will be held, as always, in the George Street Ale House at 2 p.m. on the 29th, that Sunday, in 2 days, at 378 George Street, which is just a stone's throw from the railroad station. Plenty of parking, no excuses on that account. Again, that's 2 p.m. on Sunday. Please try to make it if you are in the area or can go. All of you will be morally supportive of everyone else. And Susan's phone number, Susan's our moderator, she is to be found at 202-246-5131. That's Susan, who would like to hear from you. If you would like to come, she would be happy to give you information, and her number again is 202-246-5131. Susan, I understand, will be calling in at some point in the meeting, in the show today to talk about the meeting, so we will wait for her phone call if she calls in. Next month we will be having Jack Chavesta, who will be the moderator. Susan will be away, and I also believe that Jack will be calling in at some point, so we will take his call if and when he does decide to put in an appearance, and he will talk to you about his plans for the May meeting. So once more, that's the meetup group on Sunday, this coming Sunday at 2 p.m. in New Brunswick, New Jersey. I think I forgot to mention the city, New Brunswick, New Jersey, at the George Street Ale House. Okay, well, the official government overseer of the TARP bailout program, the Special Inspector General for TARP, Christy Romero, has stated that despite what most people think, the bailout funds have not yet been repaid. And she had this to say to Congress: after 3.5 years, the Troubled Asset Relief Program, or TARP, continues to be an active and significant part of the government's response to the financial crisis. It is a widely held misconception that TARP will make a profit. The most recent cost estimate for TARP is a loss of $60 billion. Taxpayers are still owed $118.5 billion, including $14 billion written off or otherwise lost. And earlier this month, Romero stated that the portion of the TARP funds which were supposed to help homeowners hadn't been disbursed. A fund to support homeowners in the communities hit hardest by the collapse of the housing bubble has disbursed just 3% of its budget and aided only 30,640 homeowners in the 2 years since its creation, according to a report released on Thursday by a federal watchdog office. The so-called hardest hit fund, that's the name of the fund, which was created in the spring of 2010, grants money to state housing finance agencies for efforts to help families that are facing foreclosure. It has, quote, experienced significant delay because of a, quote, lack of comprehensive planning by the Treasury Department and limited participation by Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and the large mortgage servicers, said the report by the Special Inspector General for the Troubled Asset Relief Program. Look at the TARP money that goes out to the banks, said Special Inspector General Christy Romero in an interview with the Huffington Post. Quote, that goes out in a matter of days, This has been 2 years, and only 3% of these funds have trickled out to homeowners. End of quote. Not only that, but the big banks continue today to be bailed out through a wide variety of overt and hidden schemes, while the little guy gets nothing. This is true even though the American people were opposed to the bank bailouts from day one and continue to oppose them. According to a recent Rasmussen survey, just 20% think it was a good idea for the government to provide bailout funding to banks and other financial institutions, but 60% say otherwise. Overall, 68% believe that most of the bailout money went to the very people who created the nation's ongoing crisis, but 12% disagree and 21% aren't sure. And as one of the common sayings of Occupy Wall Street protesters goes, banks got bailed out, we got sold out. Oh well, such is life, ladies and gentlemen, and as I say, search as you may through the mainstream press, you're not going to find anything about this anywhere. So either you believe me or you have to find alternative sources of information, but don't depend on the mainstream. All right, so Susan is online. She is on hold. Susan Alexander, let me welcome her to the program. Susan, this is good to hear from you, and the line is yours. Please go ahead.
Hi, Richard. I wanted to talk about the meetup, and I wanted to say that unfortunately I was not able to find anyone, any freight forwarding company that would agree to come or even be Skyped in that could commit to that. So I've done some research on my own, and I plan to share that at the meeting. But as I mentioned earlier, the other half of the meeting, half of the meeting will be about plans to leave. People will discuss what they are planning to do, where they're planning to go, the freight forwarding. And the other half, we'll talk about staying. Those are people who have decided to stay, what their plans and strategies are for, I guess, how would you say this, riding out the storm that is coming. And I also have some books, some free gifts for the first four people that show up at the meetup. And what else do I want to say? And I also have
Susan, did you, Susan, one second,
yeah?
Sorry, did you get a call from somebody in, and I think in China, who wanted to call in via Skype and talk about teaching English as a foreign language in China? Did you ever get a call from that person?
No, I didn't, but that would be super.
Well, wait for his call. His name is Brian, and he should be calling in, you know, any time.
Okay, so he's gonna call me.
Or yeah, he's very knowledgeable about Skype. He's very knowledgeable about Skype, and he's going to tell you about how to set it all up and everything else. So, anyway, just wait for his call. He should be calling. He has a U.S. number, so he should be calling sometime today.
Okay, and I also found through Johnny Miller a new resource for people who are considering moving abroad. A really good resource that I want to share with the group on Sunday.
Good. Yeah. Well, sounds like an interesting meeting, ladies and gentlemen. Let's have you all come over, and Susan will greet you with open arms. So, Susan, thank you very much again for calling in and giving us some of your plans. And
Before we hang up, I wanted to say there's about three people that called me. I haven't had a chance to call them back yet, but I'll call them today or tomorrow, hopefully. And I have a couple of questions for you, Richard.
Go ahead.
Okay. So the first one is, what are your thoughts about this computer-generated trading and what that means for the market? And the second question is, who's to say that this current economy won't just pile on more debt and continue for another 5 to 10 years or more just the way it has been? I remember some years back I read a book about the crash of 1990 or something like that. The author predicted a major financial crash. He predicted that home prices were going to go down, et cetera, and the costs were in debt, and particularly government did. And it made perfect sense. But somehow, the powers that be were able to kick the can down the road, make the problem bigger, but also allow for everything to kind of keep going for a longer time. Who's to say that that won't happen again now? And then the third...
Okay, let me take your first question first, Susan. Let me take the one about the program trading. I have never been fond of criticizing program traders for market moves, because it's always the same thing. For every program trader who buys, there's another who sells. And so the two basically cancel each other out. They play their games, indisputably. They do play their games. They are very powerful in terms of volume in the market, and they provide liquidity and the rest of it. But the point is that those who buy are buying from those who are selling. So it's a zero-sum game among those particular people. That demographic of market operators provides you with... a non-event, basically. It's a very powerful kind of tearjerker, as it were, to complain about how these people are pushing the market and how grim it is and what a scandal and all the rest of it. But it isn't. It's a non-starter, in my opinion. It doesn't work when you have, you know, either speculators or market operators of one sort or another who basically buy and sell for a living, because that's what they do. They basically cancel each other out. So I would urge people really not to spend too much energy, you know, fighting such people in terms of looking at the high dudgeon of why the markets go up or down, despite what they really should do. Now, on your other question, which basically is, why can't the system just keep going the way it's been going and just carry on indefinitely? The answer is because it reaches saturation at some point. And so, of course, your next question is going to be, well, where is the point of saturation? I think I can identify it in Europe right now. Europe has really decided, in its infinite wisdom, that this whole concept of austerity isn't working. I think they're wrong, but that seems to be what they're saying. And it was really just a matter of time before they did say it, because people hate to be disciplined. They hate to decide that they've made mistakes and they've got to take the consequences. So now they're thinking that they, for political reasons, quite apart from anything else, because governments seem to fall on the basis of this austerity plan that go into operation in these countries. Now they seem to want to let up on the austerity, but Germany is putting its foot down and saying, absolutely no way, we are not going to give any more money in to this whole idea of just throwing more money at the problem. You know, the idea of hurling crates of whiskey at the alcoholic to make him feel better. And that's basically what you do when you put more debt upon debt upon debt to try to cure debt. It doesn't work. I knew it from the start. A number of other people knew it. Apparently Ben Bernanke didn't know it. Apparently the European Central Bank didn't know it. So they're going to learn the hard way. And I think they're learning. They're understanding that the economy doesn't improve when they put this money in. The statistics don't get better. Housing doesn't improve. Unemployment doesn't improve. So what you're seeing is the play out of the theory and the impotence of the theory, followed by obviously the retraction of the concept. And that's what I think you're going to see in the very near future. That's why I think it's all going to end very soon, Susan. Does that answer your question?
Kind of, but I mean, the austerity measures caused a lot of pain. Look at Greece. You know, they cause all this pain. So what you're saying, if I understand you correctly, is they need to continue down that road, you know, let them default or whatever's happening, stop public spending on things like social welfare, et cetera, orphans and all that, slow it down to a trickle until there's so much poverty that there's no way to go but up. Is that the idea?
Well, that's what has been happening up until now. I mean, obviously, it doesn't work to starve people, and it doesn't work to take away their livelihoods. But it doesn't work either to throw money at them. And you know, there are two sides of this coin. And, you know, the one overriding factor which cannot be avoided is that all debts get repaid or defaulted on. Mm-hmm. Now, what I have said before, and what I'm going to talk about if I've got time in the second half, is how we do this, how actually we set about basically defaulting. In 1921, the potential depression that was announced through a recession was much, much worse than the ultimate depression of 1929. But the government did nothing. And guess what? In 18 months, it was all over. It was the same thing with Iceland. And I'll talk about that too. In fact, I think we have to stop and take a break here right now, Susan. But listen on. I've got some more to say about this after the break. And let me just once again wish you good luck for the meetup group on Sunday. I'll be I'll be fast asleep, of course. It'll be 2 o'clock in the morning here. But I'll be definitely rooting for you, and good luck, everybody. Support Susan. Go and enjoy the afternoon, and let me know what happens after when it's all over, Susan. Okay? Thanks very much for calling in, and have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, ladies and gentlemen, let's take a break, and I'll be right back. Okay, we're back. Just got an email from Mike talking about computer trading, and his email reads, "Susan's question with 3 exclamation marks. Computer trading makes the brokerage firm's money. It's like gambling. The bookie always makes the money." Mike, I don't disagree with that. I wasn't in any way addressing that particular aspect. I was only addressing the disparity between where the market perhaps ought to be and where it is, and how people blame the computer program traders. I'm just saying that they're not responsible for the market moves. Of course they make money. I couldn't agree with you more. But given that they don't move the market per se, I don't really think that they're a relevant issue to be contended with when you're trying to define where the market's going to go. That's all. That was my only issue. Right. We have on the line Jack Chavesta, who is going to be our moderator for the month of May. And Jack has been showing a lively interest in the group for these last few months, and I couldn't be happier to have him with us. And I am very pleased that he has stepped up to the plate and offered to do this for us in May. Jack, welcome to the show. And how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. I'm doing great, Richard. Thank you very much for inviting me to be on your show.
Okay, so what would you like to tell us about your plans for May?
My plans for May. Actually, to be honest with you, I haven't put together a theme, but I will work on that. But what I wanted to do was, if it's okay with you, to address the... you spoke about someone in the IT field on your previous show, and I wanted to address that.
I'm sorry, the IT, what was that, the information technology? I don't
know. Right, well, on your previous show, there was someone, that you read a message by someone who is basically struggling, who has been laid off from his position working as in information technology. And I have some information that I think may be able to help him.
Well, go ahead. Let's
okay.
Hear it.
Okay. So first, a website. There's a website that I would like to put out, which is idealist.org. So the word idealist.org, and this is geared towards the nonprofit sector. So what I like about this, what I think is useful about this website, is it's very well organized and it has different sections for internships, for jobs. There's a lot going on in this website. So I did put in IT to see what they have in positions, and there were a few that I saw, and there were two in Mexico, and I don't remember where the others were at, but I think that'd be a good place to start. Once again, idealist.org. There are jobs in other countries abroad, so I don't know if that individual is thinking about basically going to another country. So now,
That's very useful and interesting news. I hope he is in fact listening to the show, and he will take down the relevant information.
Okay. There's just, two other things I wanted to add. Do I have enough time, Richard?
Go ahead.
Okay. So the other thing, there's another organization, a nonprofit organization, and it's called the Perscholas. And so it's spelled Perscholas. And this is, the website is www.perscholas.org. Now, I met the person that works there as the director. He's in charge of the director for the Veterans Outreach and Recruitment. So basically what they do is they provide education for the IT field. But what I would do if I was in his position and the person that you spoke about on your last show, I would send this person, John Lewis, a message and basically explain my situation, but I wouldn't make it about me. I would put the idea about maybe forming some type of support group, and this way maybe something can come out of it. Maybe John Lewis may be able to help him, maybe not, I don't know, but I think it's worth a try. So his cell number is 646-418-8306. His number again is 646-418-8306. His name is John Lewis at Perscholas. Okay, so, and I wanted to share some information, just a little bit of information on language learning. So, Richard, do I still have enough time?
Very quickly, go ahead. Yes, absolutely.
Okay. So let's see. I got three books that I recommend. The first one is written by A.G. Hawke, H-A-W-K-E, and it's called The Quick and Dirty Guide to Learning Languages Fast. I started reading this. I haven't read it all completely, but I would definitely recommend this book. It's a good tool. The next one by Barry Farber.
Repeat each one twice, would you?
Okay, you got it.
Jack?
So the first one, The Quick and Dirty Guide to Learning Languages Fast. This is written by A.G. Hawke, H-A-W-K-E. So I read the first chapter, and I would definitely recommend this book. So once again, A.G. Hawke, The Quick and Dirty Guide to Learning Languages Fast. The next book, another very useful tool, written by Barry Farber. This is How to Learn Any Language Fast. So this Barry Farber, he used to have a show on Progressive Radio Network. So once again, Barry Farber, How to Learn Any Language Quickly, Easily, and Expensively, Enjoyably, and on Your Own. But if you type his name in, you'll get information on his book. And the other one, the last one, Speak Like a Native. And this is written by Michael D. Janich, J-A-N-I-C-H. Once again, Michael D. Janich. So the title is Speak Like a Native. I read this book I read from front to back, and this is definitely a gem. It's a very useful tool. So there you have it, Richard, and just some information I wanted to put out there for the for your listeners.
Thank you very, very much, Jack. Do you have a date for May's meetup group yet or not?
No, not yet.
Okay, well, we'll talk about that after Monday.
You got it.
So thank you, Jack, very much.
You're very welcome, Richard.
And we wish you well, and good luck for the May group.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You
okay,
too. Bye.
Bye-bye now. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, well, that's good to hear from Jack, and please support him, and I'm sure he will have something fun for you on the meetup group at the end of May. Well, Europe is absolutely and truly falling apart. Today we had a report of the fastest drop in German retail sales since April 2010, as an 18-month run of growth comes to an end. Lower sales and strong market competition resulted in a sharp and accelerated decline in margins across the German retail sector. The latest fall in margins was 17th in consecutive months and also the steepest for 2 years. French retailers reported a sharp reduction in sales during April. The month-on-month fall was the most marked recorded by the survey since data collection started in January 2004. Sales were also down considerably on a year-on-year basis, while previously set plans were again missed. The weak sales performance occurred despite evidence of substantial discounting and promotions among retailers, which resulted in a further steep drop in gross margins. The headline retail PMI plunged to a series record low of 41.4 in the latest month from 50.2 in March. The latest reading was below the neutral 50 mark for the first time since January and indicative of a steep month-on-month decline. The extent of the latest failure to meet targets was the greatest for 1.5 years. The Eurozone retail sales plunged to 41.3, the lowest since the depths of the financial crisis in November 2008. All three countries surveyed posted lower sales with a record decline in France. Cost pressures for retailers are at a 16-month low. For the first time since September 2010, retail sales fell across Germany, France, and Italy. The rate of contraction in Germany was the fastest since April 2010. Italy continued to see the steepest overall rate of decline, however, as the pace of contraction re-accelerated to approach the record level posted in January. The annual rate of decline in the Eurozone retail sales was also one of the strongest since the survey started in January 2004. Sales have fallen on an annual basis each month since last June. S&P lowered the long-term grade for the second time this year in Spain to BBB+ from A with a negative outlook. Spain's short-term rating was reduced to A2 from A1, according to New York-based S&P in a statement yesterday, and I quote, "Spain's budget trajectory will likely deteriorate against a background of economic contraction. At the same time, we see an increasing likelihood that Spain's government will need to provide further fiscal support to the banking sector. As a consequence, we believe there are heightened risks that Spain's net general government debt could rise further." Ladies and gentlemen, this is absolutely catastrophic, what I have just told you. It is truly grave and grim in the extreme. Europe is set to collapse in an out-of-control spiral which will just keep going and have absolutely no sign of any kind of turnaround for years to come. I cannot emphasize the severity of this. I just cannot tell you how very serious this is. It was not expected to happen this way. All of the measures that have been taken to try to control this have failed. They have failed miserably, whether it's austerity, whether it's government largesse, printing money. Nothing has worked. And unfortunately, these countries are going to have to implode one by one. God knows how much social unrest there will be, but I am very concerned now for anybody who has either money in these countries or even in the case of Greece, who even lives there. I would tell you, if you were a Greek resident, you need to leave that country. You need to take your things and go. That's how serious it is in Greece. And of course, I fear that it will come to the same thing in the other countries. I don't live in Greece, I don't represent Greece, therefore I don't feel a sense of responsibility towards the Greeks. But if it was the United States in this condition, I would tell you, you have no time any longer to waste. There is nothing to be gained in trying to create a life for yourself in that country. You need to go right now. That's how bad it is. And so, ladies and gentlemen, you've been warned. This is going to happen in many different places, and the United States has some time left, but it's going to come to the same thing in the United States sooner rather than later. All right, well, let's take some emails while we have them. We have one from Steve Meraldo, which came in saying, "Hi, Richard. Just wanted to say I really loved your show on 4/20/2012. I think it's good that you revisit the subject of derivatives every once in a while. It's easy to forget that the derivatives market even exists if you're not involved in it directly. Also loved the clips of Nigel Farage and Classic Carlin. I was thinking it might be interesting if you spent a few minutes on explaining what contrarianism is. I have a hard time explaining the concept to people or even explaining my own view. For example, a possible misinterpretation would be that the ideal place to move right now is Greece or America. There's a subtle difference between just doing the exact opposite of what everyone else believes, though this may work in investing, to knowing that what is usually popular is often flawed, and that's generally beneficial to be wary of what the herd is thinking and believing at any given moment. Best, Steve." Well, thank you, Steve. Let me very quickly mention the advantages of an understanding of contrarianism. It works in many different fields. Most notably in what I deal with, it works in investments. In other words, when everybody is looking in one direction, it's best to go in the other. It's a bit like being on a boat. When everybody is going over to one side of the boat, the boat's likely to topple over, and your best chance of survival, frankly, is to get on the other side of the boat and bring a few people back with you so that the boat will right itself. In investment terms, let me very quickly give you an example. When the stock market goes up, it goes up because people are becoming more and more bullish on the future of the stock market. Therefore, they are buying stocks, and therefore, the weight of the buyers is greater than that of the sellers, and therefore, the stock market will go up. Now, here's what's interesting. On the day that the stock market tops out, whenever that is, I'm not giving you an example of the current situation. I'm giving you a generalized example of what happens in the stock market. On the day when the stock market hits its top, most people are bullish. Most people are thinking that the stock market is going much higher. In fact, that is the point at which you will see the maximum number of people who are positioned in a bullish way, because that's why the market has hit its top, because the maximum number of people have already bought. Therefore, if you are going to make money, you need to be positioned the other way round. You need to be a short seller, or at the very least, out of the market, because all the buyers have bought, and now the only direction for the market is logically down as the sellers come in and as the buyers basically come at much lower levels, if at all, and that's what sends the market back down again. So contrarianism basically means the idea that, used intelligently, of course, when most people think something, the chances are very great that the best course of action is the opposite to what most people are doing as pertains to their view, which may be one-sided, and therefore you probably want to do the opposite. It works in many different fields, not just in investing, but I always use investing as the example because it's the easiest example to cite. So, Steve, I hope I've given you some clear indication of what to tell your friends. As I say, it does really work. So there you go. A couple more emails before we go. Steve Kruger came in saying, "Richard, we are truly in a hole that keeps getting deeper with no way out. The banks, with the help of Congress, have painted us into a corner that they have used paint that never dries. The only way out is to walk on the wet paint, but that will ruin everything, so they keep off the wet paint. I have to say the only reason university is so expensive is because it's easy to get student loans. The loans are a home run for the banks. You can't shed them in bankruptcy, and I'm not certain that your death voids the loan. Loans of this nature are exactly why people left Europe in the 16 and 1700s. The loan doesn't even address the quality of the education you're buying. You are paying top dollar for silk, and you are coming home with burlap. Steve Kruger. Thank you very much for that, Steve. What could I say? Thank you. Very, very kind. Well, ladies and gentlemen, you know, Americans are angry. They are angry, there's no question. Americans are not happy campers these days. You see it in the news. You see it in comments that follow almost all news stories or blogs. And the blogs that I follow, frankly, are some of them are unprintable these days. It used to be very sedate, very informative. You know, they're seething because their politicians have sold them out. They're angry because 98% of the so-called news and information they get are from tilted news entertainment industries with political motives of their own. They're angry because they're being goaded into being angry and hateful instead of concerned about the important things. Why worry about the deficit when there are more important things to worry about, like gay marriage, abortion, or the death penalty? When this thing finally does hit, when the economy tanks and unemployment soars to undreamed of levels, there's going to be a firestorm of riots, destruction, and chaos. And if you don't believe me, look at Greece. You know, it's easy to say, get ready for it. But the reality is, getting ready for the end of an era is not such an easy thing. Especially today, where the average citizen is stupid, ignorant, and stubborn. And sadly, the average American today is nothing like the original citizen. There is no unity in your country, ladies and gentlemen. There is no pride. There is no compassion. And in that, it's going to get pretty ugly in the future. I have to, you know, tell you that according to official government-produced figures, it's not just me making this up, since June 2009, for every new person who has found a job, two supposedly have been disabled. At least they've been added to the list of people receiving SSID benefits. You know, how ridiculous is that? If that's not an open and shut indication of falsified figures, I don't know what is. And if you go to the government website, you will see that you just have to show that this, you have a condition that will prevent you from working for at least a year, and you must show that you've been employed in the past. If you're 60 years old, for example, you need to show 9.5 years of previous employment. During the Nixon administration, approximately 2% of the labor force was disabled, and now it's over 6%. It seems, therefore, fair to say that disability rather than employment is Obama's real achievement. You know, since June of 2009, he's added 4.7 million people who are judged too crippled, too stupid or fat or lazy to be, and depressed to find work. I'm sorry to say, you know, that's basically what we have to look forward to. And I don't blame the people, by the way, for, you know, using disablement as a means to survive, because each and every person has to do what they have to do, but it's a pretty grim predicament. Well, forgive me if I end with this old one. I'm sure some of you have heard it before, but I just saw this comment myself for the first time. I thought it fit to pass on, ladies and gentlemen, and it comes as follows. They sent my census form back again in response to the question, do you have any difference? I had replied, 12 million illegal immigrants, 3 million crackheads, 42 million unemployable people, 2 million people in over 243 prisons, half of Mexico, and 535 more in the U.S. House and Senate. Apparently, this was not an acceptable answer. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, I bid you farewell and a wonderful weekend, and I shall talk to you again on Monday. Goodbye. Thank you.